Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
You choose me?
Happy Valentine's.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. It's Valentine's Day.
Oh, I see you wore red.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure you planned that, too, when you woke up this morning. I'm going to put on some red for the holiday.
You know how I like to get into the holiday swing of things.
Oh, yeah.
No question about it. And that calls to mind the question of the best, most creative ad campaign this Valentine's Day season, because I really consider it more of a season than just a singular day.
It's kind of the month of February, you know, build you up to Valentine's Day. That's when they all have all the trinkets out and candies.
There's no question.
Shoving it down our throats that you have to be loved by somebody today. I'm not bitter.
Right.
No, I'm not.
Did you have to make one of those little Valentine's Day mailboxes in grade school, and you would get all the Valentines from everybody in the class, and I would sit there and get no Valentine's?
No, I mean, back then,
I would have to make up.
Back then, you could choose to be nice to people. Now you have to be nice to everybody, honestly, because you can't just bring one.
It's true.
Because we don't want to make anybody feel bad or less loved than other kids.
But here's the thing. You know
my box was overflowing.
You know, still, though.
My box was overflowing. It was the best.
You still know, though, that even in this day where you have to give Valentine's Day to everybody, you know, participation trophy, the kids still indicate who they really don't want to give a Valentine's Day card to. They kind of I had to do this. So I know that look, because that's the look I get, I used to get and still get in so many respects.
Was your box a quarter way full? Did you get any B-mines, or
The ones that I entered into my box.
The ones that you self-wrote. Your
very, very Valentine's much Ralph Wiggum-ish was my Valentine's Day. So here are the entrants. Best marketing for a Valentine's Day marketing campaign, ad campaign. The combination of Coke, which I think their earnings report today. I wonder if this will be reflected. Coke and Delta Airlines.
Yeah, because Coke's based in Atlanta and Delta's in Atlanta. So they teamed up to do something fun in the sky. It's like the early Mile High Club, right?
Nothing, by the way, says Valentine's Day like an earnings report. The napkins on Delta Airlines flights. I'm trying to get to this all week. I guess Valentine's Day is an opportune time.
Yeah, I blogged about it yesterday. I wanted to know if you've ever had a plane crush. Do you know what that is? When you walk on your plane and you think, oh, that guy's hot. I want to get to know him. And Delta helped you meet the guy next to you.
No,
you've never had a plane crush?
That's a thing? What's a plane?
Oh, my gosh. You know how you get a crush, but it's called a plane crush.
Who calls it that besides you?
Oh, no. A lot of people do. Uh-huh. A lot of my girlfriends say, oh, I was on a plane. The guy in seat 2C, I had a plane crush on him. Uh-huh. Have you ever been delivered a drink by somebody saying, hey, that guy in row 1C wants you to have this?
No.
Oh, I have. You haven't had that happen?
Have I had a guy buy me a drink on a plane? No. I haven't. It's interesting you find that surprising.
Yeah, it's a plane crush.
Here's the Delta Airlines Coca-Cola napkin.
It's the best thing.
Because you're on a plane full of interesting people and hey, .. ellipsis is what we call that. You never
Words
know.
With Proft.
Because you're on a plane full of interesting people and hey, .. you never know. And it created sort of a backlash, people calling that creepy.
Yeah, but then the other side of the napkin, you have to put your name down and what seat you're in. So if you flip that side over that you read, it says your name and then what row number you're in. It's awesome. Then the flight attendant delivers it to that person, and then you've got a plane crush. Yeah!
That is creepy.
That's not creepy at all. Some fun in the sky, Dan. Good way to kill 4 hours. And then maybe you get the person next to you to switch seats so that you could sit next to your plane crush.
This is going in the direction of the Mile High Club, and I don't want to go there. Dennis in Crystal Lake has a Valentine's Day message.
Dan, I've been there too many times. Don't worry about it.
The what?
Hey, Amy, I got the old the box thing, and it's visualized in my head, and I'm getting sick. But anyways,
okay.
The only reason for this day is for me to take and not give. I want chocolate.
Okay, Dennis, we'll get some
I'll
chocolate.
I'll put it in your mailbox.
Stat. What? I want chocolate. Okay.
And I want chocolate now.
So there's the, you're on a plane full of interesting people and hey, dot, dot, you never know. That's one. And this.
Well, yeah, they yanked it because somebody on Twitter said it was creepy and now they have to be politically correct and they take out all the fun for flying.
I don't know that that makes it fun, but okay, sure.
You can also put your phone number on the napkin, too.
I have the napkin holder, I suppose.
Well, they have a line, too, for your cell phone number if you want to put that in.
Great. You've really researched this. The other entrant, Reebok Russia.
Yeah, well, you mentioned this yesterday. What is this?
Reebok.
Well, I know.
And in Russia.
Wait, that big country over there?
Yeah. The ad campaign, sit not on the needle of men's approval, sit on men's face.
Anything about anything. I'm so tempted to say something, but I'm thinking before I speak.
The
is there a picture associated with the?
There were pictures.
Oh, of women sitting on men's faces?
There were provocative pictures.
Oh, I'm looking that up right now.
Unfortunately, after the publication of some pictures, it became clear that part of the content could not be published on behalf of the brand due to the age policy of the social network, said Reebok Russia. Reebok Russia's marketing director resigned over this ad campaign. The company showed disrespect for itself. It signed up to this, approved all the quotes, and was even delighted with how bold and interesting and in line with the global strategy to do something bright and unusual. There are two parts to the ad, in case you missed them. Sit not on the needle of men's approval, sit on men's face is the slogan. The two parts, approval, right, and pleasure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. The first part, again, according to the marketing whiz over at Reebok Russia, the first part calls for being yourself. The second part calls for people to give pleasure to each other.
Okay.
That's a real Valentine's Day zinger, huh?
I have banned myself from discussing this.
You're not going to.
I'm looking at some of the pictures.
Be patronizing.
I see where
Reebok
they're going
Russia.
With this. But I understand why the marketing manager resigned over this.
Mm, yeah. Uh-huh. Remember, I haven't even thought about Reebok in a long time. The last time I thought about Reebok,
you
it was
owned
when...
a pair of Reeboks?
No. The last time I thought about Reebok was when D. Brown pumped himself up with the Reebok pumps before he won the dunk contest. Remember?
That's right.
D. Brown, the Celtics?
I had a pair of Reebok high tops. Surprised you didn't. But then again, I was a player.
Yeah. As everybody in athletics knows, the players were Reebok.
Oh.
No.
Two of them were Reeboks.
Never.
Reeboks.
That was like when you, that's like guys who had like rolled up jeans that were cuffed.
Right. And that was my era. We'd wear rolled up jeans that were cuffed and then you have your Reeboks on.
How old are you?
Cream? No, thank you. I take it black. Like my man.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Just rounding out some Valentine's Day matters. Tinder for cows. Tinder
Wait,
for cows.
Wait, which one is the... Is it Grindr or Tinder? Which one's the gay apps?
Yeah. I'm not falling into that trap. Nice no. try. I have no,
no
idea.
I don't. All right, fine. I'll Google it then. If I can't get it from Dan, I Google. All
Tinder
right?
for cows, and I'm not talking about the audience Tinder. Or the view.
Wait, Tinders are hookups, right? Where you just want to get together and have a little fun.
Nice
play
try.
Play a little patty cake.
Nice try. Not
Come
happening.
On, Dan.
A British startup has launched a Tinder-style app called Tutter.
Tutter.
Yeah.
I see what they're doing there.
To hook farmers up with cows. No, not in that way. Get your mind out of the gutter. There it is.
Bestiality. Does not
tell
rain
Scott
here,
the cow guy
right?
this. The
I know what Grindr is.
The okay. Welcome to the internet and the app world. The app Tutter allows farmers to find breeding matches by viewing pictures of cattle with details of their age, location, and owner.
I see.
It's positively innocuous and business oriented.
Sure.
Users hear a mooing sound as they swipe. That's a right swipe to show the cows some love, and left is to nix the bovine's affections. Wow. If there's a match, the app shows a heart and the words "match found." The icon of the app is a big red udder.
Oh, that's cute.
It's sort of disgusting, isn't it? Also,
everybody needs to be loved, Dan.
Hearts go out to San Francisco. San Francisco, full of young tech entrepreneurs and so forth. There's a problem, though, and it's not because they don't have Tutter. It's because everybody's polyamorous there and poly everything.
Polyamorous words with Proft.
It's just anything goes. And so this complaint forum on Reddit points out, everybody is poly. It's pretty funny how people can have different views and experiences that vary so much. My friends from New York complain that everyone wants a relationship. They all miss the quick flings. In the Bay Area, the complaint is polyamorous. It's just, you know, they're trying to hook up with cattle and everything else under the sun.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Michael Cohen was supposed to testify yesterday in Congress. He said that he had pain from shoulder surgery.
On AM 560.
Well, on Saturday night, he was out with the boys in New York at a swanky restaurant. If you're going to call in sick for your congressional testimony, don't go out and party the night before.
Toga, toga, toga. The answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy and Jussie Smollett. Says he's peed off. He is peed off.
Yeah.
All he's done is tell the truth. He's the victim in this case, and he got a little emotional in a preview of his interview that will air this morning on
Good Morning America.
Yeah, Robin Roberts, fresh off her riveting Liam Neeson interview. She's got Jussie Smollett.
She's getting all the good people, isn't she, Dan? Yeah, so at 6:07, we should have more of this interview. So, but they let out a little teaser yesterday where he did have tears in his eyes because, gosh darn it, he's the victim.
I'm pissed off. What is it that has you so angry? Is it the attackers?
It's the attackers, but it's also the attacks. It's like, you know, at first it was a thing of like, listen, if I tell the truth, then that's it because it's the truth. Then it became a thing of like, oh, how can you doubt that? Like, how do you not believe that? It's the truth. And then it became a thing of like, oh, it's not necessarily that you don't believe that this is the truth. You don't even want to see the truth.
In the world did he just say?
I don't know what that means. I don't. It's
well,
not,
when you lie, you got to keep the lie going. So you make up things, grabbing words from the air. I don't know. That was not an answer.
It's not necessarily you don't believe this is the truth. You don't even want to see the truth. So you're not, I guess he means you're not even like open-minded to the possibility of this being true. I don't know. I'm trying to give him the benefit of the doubt. It's a struggle. Here's the question I wonder if Robin Roberts asked. How do you think the Chicago police are handling it? If you're so peed off, what would you say about Chicago police? Because I would like to hear him hold forth on the police investigation. Not even necessarily speculating on why there's no video of his alleged attackers, other than the two shadowy lurking suspects caught on the one camera.
We'll get to that.
That are, as somebody pointed out, actually walking away. I think it was CWB Chicago, walking away from where the alleged attack allegedly occurred about 15 to 20 minutes before it occurred. He addressed that, too, the video.
Yeah, which, by the way, not one tip has been generated from the release of this video of two shadowy figures walking in the night.
Police have gone through a lot of video, and they were able to capture an image of two people of interest. Have you seen that image, mm-hmm. and do you believe that they could possibly be the attackers?
I do.
What is it about their size, or what? Why do you feel that they could possibly be?
Because I was there. I mean, that, for me, when that was released, I was like, okay, we're getting somewhere. You know what I'm saying? So,
no.
Yeah. I don't have any doubt in my mind that that's them.
And then when he's answering this question, Dan, I don't know if you're into body language or not, but I've interviewed so many people that when they're talking to you and if they shift down with their eyes and don't look at you and then shift down again the other way, they're not telling the truth. And to me, that was acting. Well, to me, in his heart, I do not believe that he thinks that those two people, he's just, were his attackers. He's just saying that because that's all they have.
Well, I would like to hear him expound on that a little bit. Maybe Robin Roberts offered a follow-up. I guess we'll find out in about 20 minutes. You think that's them. Well,
why?
Yeah, why? Specifically, I mean, like, I was there. What does that mean? What about that image is consistent with what you remember about the alleged attackers, or just for the purpose of the interview, remember about the attackers? Are you sure, Jesse, that you're not basing this on the internet meme where somebody superimposed MAGA hats with them carrying a bottle of Clorox and a noose? Are you sure you're not looking at that?
That meme was pretty funny. Here's the thing, though. When I looked at that surveillance of those two shadowy figures, they looked African-American to me.
Well, how
they
do you
didn't
even tell?
Seem white.
How
they
do you,
didn't look,
how do you tell?
I don't know. They just...
Well, to me,
they seemed like African-Americans. I remember we had Paul Hubel on the show, and he thought one was a woman, but I didn't think that person was a woman. The person to the right could be a woman. So I just think that those people were just walking home from a night out and had nothing to do with this.
Yeah, I don't think we need to do Rorschach ink blots of those two silhouettes. They just say, all we have is two silhouettes. They're walking away from where the attack allegedly occurred 15 to 20 minutes before it occurred. And you say you think that's them based on what exactly? Because there's two of them, and you said there was two attackers. What is it that indicates to you that it's them? Because you need to find two people on video somewhere and say, yeah, that's got to be them. And
because if it's not them, who else would it be?
Well, I mean, I would also be interested to hear him provide more detail on what exactly happened that night.
And she better ask him about that MAGA comment, too, because more of these that I'm reading of these investigations, they're leaving that out about the MAGA country, that this is MAGA country. And that's piquing my interest, thinking, are they eventually going to say that that never happened, that was, you know, an embellishment? And then these phone records that he gave just are so heavily redacted, it doesn't even show the time when the call was made to his manager, allegedly, who he was on the phone with during the attack.
If he criticizes police, that may be, you know, what Chicago police need to get over the hump politically.
Ooh, yeah.
And so that's why I'm interested to hear if he's asked about police or what he has to say about Chicago police. And in addition, even if he's not asked, even if he doesn't say anything critical, look, he's obviously doing damage control here. This is part of a PR campaign. He feels the need to address this publicly in a soft interview on GMA with Robin Roberts, who's going to be sympathetic, going to start from his premise. And Chicago police should take note of that.
Yeah.
Because what he's trying to do, if this is false, if this story is false or embellished, what he's doing here is making it more difficult politically, culturally, for Chicago police to hold him accountable. That's what this is largely about. And I hope that maybe there's something where he, provides an avenue that makes it easier, or Chicago police have a real understanding of what he's doing and they don't tolerate it. Again, this is all starting from the alternative premise, which is that what he is saying is not at least completely factual, if not totally made up. That's the part of this I want to hear. Details and how he thinks the investigation is being handled. And I'd be very interested to hear, after this interview airs, what Chicago police's response is, as they're moving towards, ostensibly moving towards, some kind of resolution of this case.
And you know detectives are going to be watching this interview because they want to know if his story changed. Did he tell us something differently than he's telling Robin Roberts?
Yeah, sure.
On Good Morning America. They always want to know this, and they just sit by the TV and watch and take notes.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, so press conference this morning that features Tiffany Van Dyke, the wife of Jason Van Dyke, talking about his situation in prison after reportedly he was beaten up while in prison before he was put in isolation.
Well, and we don't even know if he was going to isolation. This is the thing. He was in a prison in Rock Island, Illinois, transferred to the federal prison system, to a low security prison in Danbury, Connecticut. And it's not clear why he was transferred. All we know is he was assaulted by inmates, plural, and he has facial injuries, but is expected to be okay.
According to the press release announcing this press conference, Van Dyke was kept in isolation, had no issues with other inmates while jailed in Illinois.
Right, but then they transferred him
Tuesday, during a conversation with his lawyers, Van Dyke told him he had been beaten up by other inmates 4 hours after arriving at the new prison. He said he had been put in general population and he was attacked in his cell. Then on Wednesday, Van Dyke's attorneys report they received an anonymous call from an employee at the Danbury prison who gave more details about the beating and said he was worried about Van Dyke's safety.
Yeah. So many people are upset, former police officers and current police officers. They want Governor J.B. Pritzker to commute Van Dyke's sentence immediately before he gets murdered in prison.
Not going to happen.
Oh, in fact, the opposite is happening. This week, our new Attorney General for Illinois, Kwame Raoul, wanted to revoke the prison sentence, his prison sentence, and extend it.
This is a question of law, and it's in the interest of justice that the law be followed, no matter who the defendant and no matter who the victim is in a particular case.
So they believe the judge improperly applied the law in his sentencing.
He wants Van Dyke resentenced and given more time.
Exactly.
What Kwame Raoul wants.
Yeah. And I mean, Kwame, you already won the election, okay? Sit down, shut up, leave Jason Van Dyke alone. Honestly, this is so ridiculous. This is a publicity stunt for him because he's going to be, I'm going to be the new big guy, Illinois' number one attorney. I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to take a stand. No, just stop it. Go after some defaulty crib somewhere like Lisa Madigan used to do.
Well, Kwame Raoul's a race hustler. That's what we like. So he's doing it. That's what we do in Chicago and Illinois. And that's who we elect. Kwame Raoul is an Obama protege.
Oh, I know. Yeah.
For those who don't, didn't pay much attention, don't care, understand. Candace in Mount Pleasant, Wisconsin.
Kwame Raoul is from the Obama Preckwinkle apparatus. Did I say that word right?
Yes. Sort of.
You
said it right.
I can't stand him. What he's doing is, and I think that the puppet strings, in my opinion, are being pulled by Preckwinkle, who cannot say anything herself because she's running for mayorship. So that's my opinion. I know how Preckwinkle works. I used to live in her ward. Unfortunately, she used to be my alderman, and he would follow her around like a sick puppy dog, while she was alderman. So that's who I think is really behind this push.
Thanks for the call, Candace. Well, here's the thing. It's one of those things where nothing needs to be said because they all come from the same perspective. As I said, they're all race hustlers. They're race racketeers, to borrow a Bob Woodsonism. So you don't have to tell Kwame Raoul to do anything because that's naturally what they've been weaned to do.
Coming.
But I mean, Jason Van Dyke, his fortunes are not going to change.
No.
Other than maybe how he is imprisoned in Danbury.
Yeah, or transfer him to Terre Haute, where he's closer to his family and it might be a little safer atmosphere for him.
George Ryan prison.
Yeah.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, yesterday, before the details of the border security deal that congressional Democrats and Republicans reached, before the details were announced, CNN reported Trump intends to sign the border deal to avoid another shutdown. Well, CNN's reporting it, you know, it certainly is 50-50 whether it turns out to be true.
But it might be true.
Well, here's what Trump did say, though, about the prospect of shutting down the government again.
We'll be getting it. We'll be looking for landmines because you could have that. You know, it's been known to happen before to people. But we have not gotten it yet. It'll be sent to us at some point, and we'll take a very serious look at it. We have a lot of things happening right now. We're building a lot of wall right now with money that we already have. And when people see what we're doing, I think they'll be very surprised. We're doing a lot of work, and we have planned to do a lot of work, but I have not seen it yet. I appreciate all the work the Republicans have done because they're really going against a radical left. It's a radical left, and they're going against it very hard, and they're fighting. But we're in very good shape, and we're going to take a look at it when it comes. I don't want to see a shutdown. Shutdown would be a terrible thing.
Shutdown would be a terrible thing. Going to take a look at it. Look for landmines that would clear the deal. I don't know. We've got some details. Any of these sound like landmines to you? Section 231.
I love Section 231.
It's
my favorite section.
It's a fan favorite. There's no question. It prohibits any of the funds being used to build border barriers in certain areas. It really only provides for the construction of new barriers in the Rio Grande Valley area.
Okay.
Uh-huh.
That's where it's needed the most. Actually,
$1.375 billion is for the construction of primary pedestrian fencing, including levee pedestrian fencing, in the Rio Grande Valley sector. This is from the bill. All right, so there's your
$1.375 billion.
$725 million for the acquisition and deployment of border security technologies, trade and travel assets and infrastructure, to include $570 million. $570 million for non-intrusive inspection equipment at ports of entry.
All right, new equipment for that.
Mm-hmm. Point here, just in terms of border barrier wall, I don't know how much people really care about the exact nature, the materials used for the barrier, but if you do, the amounts designated shall only be available for operationally effective designs deployed. Such as the currently deployed steel bollard designs that prioritize agent safety.
Is that by D&G?
D&G?
Donnie Dolce and Cadoce, what's it called?
Dolce and Gabbana? What?
Are they the designers of that fancy wall you speak of?
They design clothes. Okay. No concrete wall, no prototypes. Steel bollard design.
Right. Yeah, but what President Trump said yesterday.
Well, wait, there's okay, more. Well, there's more.
Is that this wall is going to be fortified, whether it be a fence or a wall.
Okay. Well, that's what I'm saying.
It's going to be harder to scale than Mount Everest. But we'll get to that. He said it.
Fortunately, you don't have to deal with too many Sir Edmund Hillarys trying to come across the border. That's the good news, I suppose. $3.1 billion in foreign health services. So more than twice the amount for border barriers, foreign health services, meaning health services for foreigners.
Okay. Right. All right.
I'm just being.
Yeah.
The other highlights, $415 million for humanitarian aid, $77 million for opioid equipment, 1,200 new custom and border patrol agents.
Okay. 1,200?
Yeah, funding
That's good.
For that. no funding for additional enforcement and removal field personnel. So no more ICE agents to deport people already in the country. 1,200 CPB. No new ICE.
All right.
Expands the alternatives to detention program from 82,000 to 100,000. So instead of housing family units at the border, they get moved into the interior. And this presents a challenge because when they're moved into the interior, they almost always stay in the country permanently. Just a couple of others. $3.4 billion in refugee assistance. That's $74 million more than last year. $4.4 billion in international disaster assistance. That's $100 million more than last year. Does not eliminate any of the agencies Trump wanted to get rid of, including the Asia Foundation, U.S. African Development Foundation, Inter-American Foundation, U.S. Trade Development Agency. So no bureaucracies eliminated. Additionally, Israel, Ukraine, and Jordan combined received $5.3 billion in foreign aid. So again, that's, you know.
That's part of the border security funding?
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's so foreign aid is in there.
Ukraine.
So that's, you know, 4X of the border barrier funding. So those are some of the highlights. What do you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA-turnkey.pro, text line. You still say swallow hard and move forward, as I do? Or is there something in here that you would characterize as one of those landmines Trump was looking for that should lead him to not sign this legislation and move in another direction to get what he wants for border security? Tom in Deer Park, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, my take, the conservative movement's missing the ball. It's another Trumpian look, squirrel. Our U.S. debt is $22 trillion. It's gone up a couple trillion since last year. That's what's going to eat this country apart. That's, in my opinion, what's going to destroy this country, not this nonsense of, in my opinion, overwrought concerns about crisis at the border.
Well, okay, thanks for the call, Tom. But one point of that, this is not a Trump-look squirrel because Trump had nothing really to do with cobbling together this compromise, right? This is congressional Republicans and Democrats who cobbled together this compromise and are leveling it up to the president.
Right.
So,
actually,
I mean,
they wanted him to stay out of it. And they
right.
So, Pelosi and Schumer to stay out of it, too.
So some of obviously what he wants was part of the negotiation. What he wants informed by border security experts, including the agencies that we rely on, like Customs.
Conservatives, are you upset that he's going to sign this bill? Honestly, because the House Freedom Caucus, they're very upset. They wanted to pass a stopgap bill and discuss this for another week to 2 weeks. You know, because he does. I mean, he promised that he was going to make Mexico pay for it. Obviously, that's not going to happen. And if he declares an executive or takes an executive action, then he's going to be relying on American tax dollars to pay for it if he wants more of the wall built.
Yeah, I mean, the American tax dollars, we're talking about relatively infinitesimal amounts of money in the grand scheme of the federal budget, number one. Number two, you know, the make Mexico pay for it. It's so tired.
But that's what the campaign done.
Backdoor pay through the new NAFTA deal.
Well, regardless, wall is being built.
We're building as we speak in the most desperately needed areas. And it's a big wall. It's a strong wall. It's a wall that people aren't going through very easy. They're going to have to be in extremely good shape to get over this one. They would be able to climb Mount Everest a lot easier, I think.
And there were pictures of him at the border in Texas in front of some of the new walling that's there.
Okay.
So that's true. Jim in Tampa, Florida.
Good morning, guys. Thanks for taking my call. I don't know how, Dan, I may have missed it when I was on hold, but I don't know how you feel about this. And I think this is written and designed to just trigger all kinds of a reaction from both Trump and the conservatives. I mean, this is just fingers in the eye all day long, the way they put these things in there. It just really, I recoil from it. I haven't had time to think about it, but my initial emotional reaction is, screw this. This isn't what are you putting all this stuff in here for? This is a joke. And I think people should be pissed at Democratic legislators that use this opportunity to do things like this. But I don't know. What do you think, Dan?
Well, thanks for the call, Jim. I'll withhold my view for a moment. Greg in Schaumburg.
Hi, Dan and Amy. The caller, two callers ago, who talked about the deficit, people like that absolutely drive me nuts. You can't look at a multiple dependent cause situation and pick out one thing and declare it to be the cause. This is interconnected, but certainly if you don't have security, then the economy goes down the drain and then you have a major problem. Trump should take this. He should then go and do every executive order that he can and pray that Roberts stays with him on the Supreme Court.
All right. Thanks for the call, Greg. What do you think?
Idea.
Sign it? Don't sign it. Aye or nay? Representative Amy Jacobson from
nay.
The great state of Chicago.
Nay. Chicago's the government
state,
shut
down. They're trying to make it a state. You know, see, some Southern Illinois legislators want to make Illinois to make Chicago a fit. Well, either way, I can't.
The 51st state?
Chicago, 51st state. So, yeah, that Chicago, the 51st state, so that Illinois, the Illinois they have down there in Southern Illinois, can be Illinois. So maybe that.
Awesome idea.
You could be a congresswoman from Lakeview.
I was from Southern Illinois. I'd want to separate from this part of the country as quick as humanly possible.
All right.
Because they have to pay for our politician sins down there, and that's not fair.
I went on a tangent.
To feed the world. Yes, yes.
Okay. And so you're a no.
I'm a no, and you're what are you?
Why are you a no?
Because this is not a deal. This is just weird. He has egg on his face, President Trump does, from what he promised the American people during his campaign. And it's 55 miles. It's nothing compared to what was recently offered was 65 miles and $1.67 billion. So he might have wanted to take that if he's the business savvy businessman that he says he is.
I think focusing on whether this is a win or a loss now. Quarreling about that is
doesn't matter
counterproductive.
All right,
I think that it's disappointing, but it's not dispositive of the issue. You still have another 2 years.
You think perhaps in 2 years people forget about this?
Well, it's not that they forget about it. It's what will he have tangibly to present in terms of the promise that he made and how well he kept it. Will he have new infrastructure on the border? Yes. Will he have the support of Border Patrol? Yes. Will he have a reduction in illegal crossings? Probably yes. So I think those tangible deliverables will supersede what we're talking about today about dollars and miles. I just think they will. And also, this is going to be an exercise in moral relativism, as most elections are, really, right?
Right.
So it's Trump and what he has gotten here and what he will have done by 2020 versus whoever the Democrats nominate. And that's likely to be somebody who at minimum has had a dalliance with the abolish ICE, walls are immoral crowd. So it's not just who you're going to choose, because that's obvious. I just don't think this will be disappointing, but I don't think it depresses his base. And I don't think it leads anyone in his base to leave him. So the smart political thing, given the reality on the ground and the decision he made to deleverage his bargaining position by ending the partial shutdown, leads you to this place.
Wow. That's a good answer.
All right. Thank you very much. The gentle lady.
I don't like what
you're saying.
The gentle
lady from Chicago.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
Happy Valentine's Day.
Bob in Buffalo Grove.
Thanks for taking my call. Trump should sign the bill, but use it as an excellent talking point for the next election, 2020, saying, I tried to build a wall, but you guys wouldn't give me a Congress to sign, give me the proper legislation. So go out and vote for people that are going to want to support me.
All right. Thanks, Bob. Steve in Hinsdale.
Yeah, I'm with Bob, Dan, and Amy. This is like a basketball game. I think he scored a two-pointer, not a three-pointer. This is going to go on for decades, and so I think it's a good win. So I'm happy he's got my vote. You know, back to this climate change thing real quick. Do you know how many people in India die a year from air pollution?
Many.
1.2 million. So, you know, it's this whole Green Deal, all this lefty stuff. We got the right man. We'll be fine. Thanks. Have a great day. Happy Valentine's Day to all my old girlfriends. Bye-bye.
Thanks, Steve. I'm sure all your old girlfriends are appreciative.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, it's taking your calls, aye or nay, with now that you know some of the details of the border security funding compromise. The details released last night. Trump has a decision to make. Margot in Burr Ridge, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Right. I think the Democrats don't really want him to sign this, because if he signs this, he'll be doing what they do, incremental imposition of what he wants and what I want. So then I can give you two good examples. I mean, abortion. First of all, you had early term abortion. Then you had second trimester. Then you had late term abortion. And now you've got infanticide. Or if you look at health care, first there was Medicaid, Medicare, you know, the VA. And then they had companies paying for employees' health care, then we got Obamacare, and now they want single payer. You know, that's how they do it, incrementally. They never give up. They always take whatever they can get to grasp further along their way. And I guess that's what he has to do here.
Yeah, that's
so I agree with you.
That's right. Thanks for the call, Margot. You know, you're going to have to claw your way back. It's not all going to happen in one fell swoop, particularly with a divided Congress. You're going to have to claw your way back to sanity. And this is, I guess, a baby step in that direction on which to build. At least that's what I would argue.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Won't you go home, Bill Daly? Won't you go home? You've been around for so long.
Yeah.
You did this 6 years ago, Bill, when you ran. But it didn't last as long as this song.
Yeah, Bill Daly, you think that's tone deaf. Bill Daly to build Chicago. Actually, this is
comical.
This is great.
Sad.
Kudos to the Tribune for this outstanding tribute to the Onion. This is an outstanding tribute to the Onion. Bill Daly to build Chicago. Chicago Tribune's endorsement. Some of the highlights. I mean, get ready to laugh. In this race, Chicago has an exceptional field of candidates, writes the Tribune. I mean, they're hilarious. They are funny men and women on that Tribune editorial board.
Well, yeah, an outstanding group. I mean, Amaya Enya now being sued by her spokesperson for not paying that bill. Didn't pay her student loans. Skipped out on her landlord a few times. But we want her in charge of our budget. And by the way, something just happened to your microphone.
Amara Enya, I mean, who cares?
She's out of it. Well, I'm just saying, if they're saying it's a wonderful field of candidates,
well,
Dan,
yeah.
Not so wonderful.
The Tribune writes, "We aren't nostalgic for old days and old ways." No, I agree. What's to be nostalgic about? You're interested in just more of the same. There's no nostalgia. It's what we have now and what you want more of. Don't change a thing, Bill Daly in 2019. I hear you. The Tribune also writes in searching for their endorsement, the process would be less freighted with controversial history if Bill Daly's name were Bill Doe. Yeah.
What in the world?
Yeah. Here's the thing about that. We wouldn't even be talking about Bill Daly if his name was Bill Doe, would we?
Right. We wouldn't be. He wouldn't be endorsed by the Chicago Tribune if his name were Bill Doe.
He wouldn't exist in politics.
He wouldn't even be running if Rahm Emanuel decided to seek another term.
Bill Daly to build Chicago. Oh, no, but this is great, too. They use Bill Daly's words to support their own. "We were impressed," essentially, the Tribune says, "when Bill Daly said, the city, the next mayor of the city has to be a salesperson for the city, correct the problems, whether it's corruption, whether it's the inequity in our city, the history of racism in the city or the country. Address them, but move the city forward. Wow.
Such impressive rhetoric.
Wow, is that powerful?
That's a great plan.
What has he done in the 70 years he's been on this planet in furtherance of those things he's now going to do as mayor, the Tribune would have you believe? More Bill Daley rhetorical flourishes. If we don't move forward with economic growth, all those good things we want to do for those who are not as fortunate as we are, we will have a hard time accomplishing them. Oh, my gosh, that is groundbreaking. Oh, that's important. That's what leadership sounds like. Are you fracking kidding me? No. You know what? Because the Tribune editorial board, the big government press corps, which they're a part of, with a couple of exceptions named Cass and McQuarrie, they like the status quo. They're like the electorate.
Well, they're even saying that they're endorsing him because of the family name. They said, yes, we're endorsing a Daley. Reawakening the Daley dynasty gives you pause. Fair enough. It gives us pause, too. Richard 1 and Richard 2 served as mayor for more than two decades apiece. Find us a Chicagoan who doesn't have strong opinions about those men and their reigns.
Yeah.
So we're just going to continue it with Bill.
One more reason Daley stands apart. Oh, I mean, there's so many. Whew. This must have been laborious to put them all together in one editorial. His experience as President Clinton's Commerce Secretary and Obama's Chief of Staff. Yeah.
And then they even mention, you know, he gets things done. Well, he ran Al Gore's 2000 presidential campaign. Yeah. Who won that race?
He didn't run his campaign. He didn't run his campaign. He was a titular chairman, campaign chairman. It's like saying John Podesta ran Hillary's. No, he didn't. Does the Tribune editorial, well, these are political people. Do they even understand how campaigns work?
I know. That's
what titles mean? So that's one thing. Commerce Secretary Owen, President Obama's Chief of Staff. Didn't we just do that for 7 years? And that was actual Chief of Staff. That wasn't sort of like a placeholder Chief of Staff, which is what Bill Daley was, because that's what he has been his entire life. He's put that guy in the room because of who he's family members with.
Right. Not put because guy, of his own credentials.
Put that guy in the C-suite, cut that guy in on the deal, find somebody to take that guy's state insurance exam for him because he's a moron like his brother, but this is a family we got to serve.
D's, Dems, and Does. Bill Daley's reaction when he heard that the Chicago Tribune was endorsing him.
Matter of fact, when Jorge Neri came in, my campaign manager, I said, Russians must have hacked the Tribune's website. Because I was really surprised by it, to be frank with you.
Yeah. Here you go, folks.
Yay.
Yay,
Illinois. Yay, Chicago. Yay. Hooray, yay. Chicago. Bill Daley to Build Chicago. What do you think? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Now, the good news is, I mean, the Tribune.
What?
As the sway the Tribune has is diminishing with each passing day. This is an echo chamber for people like the board members of the Civic Committee of the Commercial Club, the C-suite rent seekers promoted, proposing tax increases, the business community. This is for the public sector union bosses and the progressive youth proposing a city income tax and LaSalle Street tax and other things to further decimate Chicago. Even as the Tribune writes, Chicago is an abundance of taxation, but not enough employers, enough taxpayers contributing revenue to City Hall. Such a great perspective. That's exactly how the rent seekers in C-suites, that's exactly how the public sector union bosses, and who can tell the difference anymore, that's how they talk. And not enough employers or enough taxpayers contributing revenue to City Hall, because that's the point. That's the point of all this. Prop up City Hall. Prop up big government, no matter the expense, no matter the infliction of pain and suffering, no matter the push of people out of this state. out of the city and out of the state. You're a revenue generator for City Hall. That's all you are. You are enlisted to be a ward healer for the show. Ward healer for the men and women of always at City Hall. Change on the outside to protect continuity on the inside. Never a more accurate statement about Chicago was made, and it was made in Boss, the show. Yeah. Kelsey Grammer plays Mayor
of
Chicago.
I love that show.
Should have got the writers from Boss to write this editorial for the Chicago Tribune.
Oh, it's just a disgrace. Shame on the Tribune.
Vince in Crystal Lake, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, how you doing? This is Vince.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say Bill Daley's Fredo. You have the clip from Fredo when
he's smart. Fredo, he can do things.
Fredo, get that.
Yeah, get in the boat, Fredo. Yeah.
I'm smart.
Thanks for the call, Vince. Yes.
I'm not familiar with Fredo.
Fredo Daley.
Oh. Yeah.
Fredo from The Godfather.
Yeah. Oh, that movie that I...
Michael, I'm smart. I could do things. Get in the boat, I said. Jim in Willowbrook.
Good morning, guys. Hey, you know, it doesn't matter who the Tribune endorses. One of these Democrats, it doesn't matter who it's going to be. They're not going to be happy until we look just like Detroit. They're going to run us right into the ground.
But
Detroit's actually on a comeback now.
Yeah,
they raised
the
all those houses, and there's organic farming going on, and then artists are moving down there into those lofts and slowly changing.
But Bill Daley understands that the mayor has to be a salesperson for the city.
Does he?
Mike on the north side.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call. Nobody buy the Tribune anymore. Well, don't read it. Put the money in the box, take all the papers out, and throw them in a dumpster so they don't make any money. I'm tired of the Daily Friends, Felons, and Family Plan raping this city. The Tribune, everybody on the editorial board, I'm issuing a fatwa against you. Everybody go after these people. You see them on the street, give them a slap, tell them it's from me. You see them walking downtown, throw them over the bridge into the river. Give them a good cleaning. These people are part of the problem. They own a lot of property. The Dailies take care of them. Chicago was destroyed by the Dailies and Rahm Emanuel. Bill Daley and Rahm Emanuel pushed through NAFTA, and that cost us tens of thousands of small manufacturing jobs. And then the mayor mumbles, Richie, changed the zoning laws and made every factory spend tens of thousands, and in some cases hundreds of thousands of dollars, on plants and fences for their parking lots. He drove them out.
Well, GF, so all those places, GF structures, though. But I mean, but look at the planters on Michigan Avenue, Mike. Look at the planters. Look at the wrought iron fencing.
In Lakeview. Yeah,
it's nice. Maggie Daley Park.
Yeah, those planters are nice shaped. They're coffin shaped. We should put a Daley in each one of them. We should. For all they've stolen. And Bill Daley, I see you. I'm going to get you in the heart with a number two pencil.
Okay. Right. Thanks
easy
for the
there.
Call, Mike. Take
but
it
I mean,
easy.
They even went, like, we appreciate Daley's candor. He recognizes the need for reform, the politics that, yes, nurtured him and his forebears. They said that his supporting downsizing city council into a more crisp legislative body. Oh, was so courageous.
What about,
so crazy.
Where's the mention of the parking meter deal?
Where's the mention?
That he was in the middle of and has given differing answers these days as compared to what he said at the time, because, now he's running for mayor. What about the SBC deal he did with Tiny Dancer and Benedict Rohner? Where's the mention of that? Where's the mention of their own reporting on him apparently cheating to pass the state insurance exam? Character, the character stuff.
Well, that says a lot about a person.
Is there any, normally if there you have qualms about a candidate in an editorial, you'll give the reason you're endorsing him or her, but you'll also give the problems that the candidate has. No mention of those. No, not in the tank, though. No. Ron on the South Side.
You know what? The irony of it, Dan, that whole story about the him taking out his shirt, it was on the first page of the Tribune.
Yeah,
first
right.
Page.
Right.
So it's not like you don't notice, but you know what?
Well, they don't read the Tribune either, the editorial.
Absolutely. Yeah, they must not. And to tell you the truth, I couldn't care less who they endorse. I will not be voting for them. And I just hope most people, Dan, because you know what? Sometimes they're going to do the same thing. They're going to do the same thing. I mean, don't. So
they may endorse Preckwinkle. Remember, they're a big labor paper.
Yeah, you know. Yeah, you're probably right. Another loser. But it's just disgust. Hey Dan, real quick.
Wait, who are you voting for before you make your last point? Who are you with, Ron?
You know what, Dan? I have not made up my mind at this point. Oh, you know what, Dan?
Right.
Okay, I'll look at him. Yeah, I know who I'm not voting for, and so that's the guy. This is just they just have no integrity. I read them because of John Cass. But other than that, my dog can urinate on the Tribune paper.
There you go.
Have a good day.
Thanks for the
call. I don't think we should vote for anybody who threw their hat in the ring after Mayor Emanuel said he wasn't going to run for re-election. And I think everybody should vote for Paul Vallis.
You're voting Vallis or Wilson. I'm down to Vallis or Willie.
Okay. And don't vote for anyone who refuses to come on this show, because they're taking the Republican vote for granted. And that's about 135,000 people who voted for Trump, and they need those votes. That's Jerry Joyce won't come on. Susana Mendoza won't come on. Tony Preckwinkle won't come on. Bill Daley, he sleeps in. He's only available between 10 and noon for questions from the media. Okay. Who else is there?
I'll tell you what. That's another thing, too. Boy, it's going to be hard to build Chicago.
Yeah, if you had to sleep in the morning.
If you only work 2 hours a day, boy, I don't know if that's going to be enough.
He doesn't do morning radio. I mean, we have the email that says that.
Mark in Plainfield.
Dan, you set me up perfectly. If I was still living in Chicago, I'd be voting for the self-made millionaire with zero political experience. It's working great at the federal level. It'll make Chicago great again, and they want to, Willie Wilson won't have a Schumer or Pelosi to deal with.
All right, thanks for the call, Mark. There's something about going from 20 cents an hour as a cotton picker in Jim Crow, Louisiana, to sitting atop a $60 million company. That's the Willie Wilson story. It is. It's remarkable. It's a great American story. There's no question about it. Whether you vote for Willie or not, you can't deny that story. By the way, also yesterday, the filing for an independent expenditure pack in D.C. To go after Vallis and McCarthy.
What?
Yeah, that has to be... It has to be some, and it's the guy who founded Aristotle. I think it's Bill Daley. It most likely is Bill Daley.
It sounds like Bill Daley.
It could be Joyce, but I think it's Daley, because here's the problem Daley has, and boy, wouldn't this be delicious. I said yesterday before we interviewed Willie Wilson, I've seen two polls recently. Both have Willie Wilson in second position.
Oh, yeah. David Axelrod even said that yesterday. He said... it's going to be Preckwinkle, Daley, or Willie Wilson.
So, I mean, could you imagine how great would it be for a Willie Wilson to take out Bill Daley and to take out everybody who supported Bill Daley in so doing? How delicious would that be? There's your yellow vest moment potentially in Chicago, but that independent expenditure pack, probably Daley, targeting Vallis and McCarthy because he needs to...
Get the white vote?
Well, he needs to shear some of their vote away over to him to make the runoff. So look for that in the closing couple of weeks and days of the campaign now. Attacks on Vallis and McCarthy, and you can bet Daley's fingerprints will be on it.
I can handle things. I'm smart. I'm like everybody says. Like dumb, I'm smart, and I want the stats.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump yesterday, before the details of the border security deal were made public in legislative form, President Trump had this to say about what he plans to do and whether or not another partial shutdown of the government is on the table.
We'll be getting it. We'll be looking for landmines because you could have that. You know, it's been known to happen before to people. But we have not gotten it yet. It'll be sent to us at some point, and we'll take a very serious look at it. We have a lot of things happening right now. We're building a lot of wall right now with money that we already have. And when people see what we're doing, I think they'll be very surprised. We're doing a lot of work, and we have planned to do a lot of work, but I have not seen it yet. I appreciate all the work the Republicans have done because they're really going against a radical left. It's a radical left, and they're going against it very hard, and they're fighting. But we're in very good shape, and we're going to take a look at it when it comes. I don't want to see a shutdown. Shutdown would be a terrible thing.
National Review opining Republicans are stuck with a lousy deal. If it's a disappointing state of affairs, a product of poor choices by Trump and congressional Republicans. It was malpractice not to get more funding for a border barrier out of Congress when it was held by Republicans. Pretty straightforward. Though the National Review points out rightly that the Democrats might have filibustered any deal they didn't like, so it was no fait accompli, but still was much more advantageous with that distribution of power. And so I would add that deleveraging by opening up the small portion of the government that was temporarily shut down or led him to this place as well. And what's the place? You're going to get some fencing, sort of like almost like steel bollards and like a trellis type barrier in the Rio Grande Valley.
And it's going to be harder to climb than Mount Everest.
We're building as we speak in the most desperately needed areas. And it's a big wall. It's a strong wall. It's a wall that people aren't going through very easy. They're going to have to be in extremely good shape to get over this one. They would be able to climb Mount Everest a lot easier, I think.
I don't know. I'd have to put that to Sir Edmund Hillary. But here's the thing. 1,200 new CPB agents, 1,200 more. No new ICE. Money for foreign health assistance, humanitarian aid, some aid to deal with the opioid crisis and technology deployment at the border as well. Foreign aid, 4X. The amount of money allocated for border barrier funding, $5.3 billion for the countries combined, for the countries of Ukraine, Israel, and Jordan. So is this a deal that Trump loyalists just need to swallow hard and accept, forget keeping score right now, win or loss, and think about the long game, which is 2020? We'll put that to our friend Sean Davis, co-founder of TheFederalist.com, who joins us now. Sean, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So what about it? Where do you come down on what we know about what will likely head to the president's desk?
Well, I think everyone learned a valuable lesson in watching how this whole thing played out in Congress. So I personally don't think it should be viewed as, oh, this was a win for Trump or a loss for Trump. Trump. This wasn't really about him. This is about what Congress does. And just like we saw with Obamacare repeal, where Republicans had promised for years and years, if you just give us the House in the Senate in the White House, this is the first thing we're going to do. And what we learned is that in the Senate, particularly, Republicans didn't really want to repeal Obamacare. They had just used that rhetoric to get themselves elected, to get more power to do other things. And the immigration border security debate has really been that a replay of that exact same thing, where they promised to do it, they promised to do it. Well, you know what? They had majorities in Congress to do this. They could have done it. They didn't do it. And the reason they didn't do it is because they don't want to do it. So I look at the whole thing not through the lens of, is this good for Republicans or bad for Trump or good for Democrats, but is this good for the American public? Is it good for national sovereignty and national security? And I think, no, it's not at all. I think the whole thing's a farce.
What about a pathway to citizenship for Dreamers? Is that got lost in the conversation?
I think that's all part of the conversation. I don't think it is outside of the realm of possibility that Republicans or even Trump would agree to that. But you can't you don't really want to talk about if you have a big leak in your plumbing in your home, the first thing you need to do before you think about what should I do with all this water in the house is what do I need to do to make sure water stops flooding into the house? And after that's done and after you know your leak's been taken care of, then you can start discussing, okay, what's the best way to take care of what's already in the house now? You know, I can't reverse time and deal with that, so how do I address it now? I feel like that's how you need to address the immigration debate. Until you plug the holes in the border, until you stop illegal immigrants from amassing and pouring over the borders, you've got to stop that before you start saying, well, who should get citizenship or not? You have to secure the border. That has to be the first thing you do.
But Ed, aren't we in a situation, though, and President Trump specifically in the situation where, look, even if I got everything I asked for, that's not going to end the conversation about immigration to the point you were just making. All of these other issues that are all kind of under the umbrella of immigration policy, they would continue to be hotly discussed and debated. It's going to be an important issue again in 2020. So why not sort of end this chapter in the long-term battle and focus on things that really are marginalizing the left right now, like, for example, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's ravings?
Oh, I think that's a fair point, and I think that's probably where Trump will end up. It wouldn't surprise me to see him sign it and claim victory and then maybe still declare a national emergency to unfreeze some other funds that he can use for border security. He may well veto it knowing that Congress is going to override him, and then that way that it has the effect of putting that particular debate on the back burner for a little while without Trump having to get his hands dirty by approving it. And I completely agree. The only thing Democrats and the left have to do to beat Trump and Republicans is not be insane. That's all they have to do to win in 2020.
Can't do it.
And as we've watched... Go ahead.
No, I'd say they can't do it. Bridge too far. Not going to happen.
Yeah, so you see Ilhan Omar, you see Rashid Tlaib, you see these just raging anti-Semites in Congress. You see the lefty environmental, not even socialist, almost communist kooks like Ocasio-Cortez just going absolutely nuts, saying that their goal here is to ban cars and planes and, quote, they need to ban farting cows, which is actually a phrase that ended up on Ocasio-Cortez's official white paper summary of her Green New Deal.
Really?
The thing is so absurd. It's so bad for Democrats. I have no problem with Republicans running against that and making Democrats own that nonsense for the next year and a half.
Well, then what do you think of Mitch McConnell, though, calling it to the Senate floor? Like, let's take a vote on it. Let's see where you stand on this Green New Deal.
I think it's great. It's not as revolutionary or in your face as I think a lot of people have said. That's a very common election year or election season tactic where you take the other side's most ridiculous plans, you put it into legislative language and you make them vote on it. But I love the idea. Put all of these Democrat senator presidential candidates who endorsed that absurd Green New Deal on the record for voting for ending cars and ending plane travel and requiring high-speed rail and getting rid of those just awful, awful farting cows.
I mean, how do you even the people we're supposed to take seriously, the senators running for president on the Dem side? I mean, you got Elizabeth Warren lying about being an Indian. You got Cory Booker having an imaginary friend, and then Kamala Harris yesterday or this week, she lied about when she was smoking dope and the music she was listening to in college. I mean, it's all just sort of manufactured woozy dream business on the left. And so where do they come up with somebody who will be taken seriously by, you know, anybody that's not wearing a pea hat?
Well, yeah, that's the challenge for Democrats, is that their base has gotten so crazy, so increasingly leftist and socialist, that you almost wonder if someone who can get elected by normal people can even make it out of a Democrat primary. And Democrats actually have a similar problem in 2020 to what Republicans had in 2016, which is it's just a clown car of candidates. Republicans at least had an instant front runner the second he announced in Donald Trump. Once he was in, he was sucking up all the oxygen. He was the main guy the whole time. He won the primary, won the general. You don't really have that particular dynamic with the Democrats this year because there is no obvious front runner. And so it's going to create a really, really interesting dynamic where a bunch of them are trying to vie for leftist progressive support, which may box them out once the general comes along from getting any sort of moderate or independent support.
He is Sean Davis. He's the co-founder of The Federalist, thefederalist.com. Sean, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you all. Have a great day.
You too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, congratulations to JC. She is the Minnesota Women's Powerlifting State Champion.
But the problem is she is not a she. She is a he. And took the title away from some woman who deserved it. I mean, when is this going to end?
JC only took up weightlifting a year ago, and now she is the state champion. I mean, what a prodigy. Isn't that?
I wonder how she was able to compete after just a year in the
sport. She's a natural.
Oh, sure she is.
I mean, not a natural woman, but yeah, there's an organization, interesting, called Fair Play. Fair Play for Women. Dr. Antonia Lee is tweeting about this. She's got a lot of important points here. Maybe you want to consider
the show.
Consider that. I mean, do you want your daughters having to compete against men? What about your boys competing against women? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Dr. Lee tweets, powerful LGBT rights organizations pushing the right of male-born powerlifters to compete in female competition, despite clear evidence that developing and training on testosterone gives them unfair advantage against women, you don't say.
Oh, and JC set the new state record in women's bench, by the way.
I said prodigy.
And best overall lifter.
What a find in Minnesota. Powerful U.S. politicians pushing the right of male-born powerlifters to compete in male-female competition, despite that same clear evidence. You know who is one of the individuals pushing it when she talks about politicians?
Amy Klobuchar, what's her name?
Good guess. Our friend the anti-Semite.
Oh, Representative Omar.
Yeah. She tweeted,
of course she is.
I've requested an investigation into USA Powerlifting's discrimination against a member of the Minnesota trans community. That's the problem here. You can't discriminate against men competing with women in powerlifting. Dr. Lee continues, we are fighting for the right of female athletes to have fair and meaningful competition. If you're a female athlete or sports professional who cares about the future of female sport, help strengthen our voice by sharing your story in confidence with us. The fact that you have to do it in confidence for fear of reprisal says everything about where this culture's at. And as I've said for years and years and years now, ever since this junk science on gender started gaining popularity, when women's sports are eliminated, is that when people are going to stand up and take notice and stand up against this poisonous political ideology?
We fought so hard for male-free spaces, for privacy and safety and fairness and female sports. I mean, my mom was growing up. They didn't have any female sports. They had synchronized swimming. That was it. No organized sports for women.
Yeah.
And I don't want to, I mean, I coach girls. I don't want, God forbid, if a guy shows up to try out for a girl's team.
How about
transgender?
How about when all the record setters in women's sports are men?
No, I know. Yeah. Because that's going to happen.
Mo on the Northwest side.
Hey, how you doing? I mean, where are all the scientists? Where are all the doctors? Do you recall people getting in trouble for taking steroids because it's enhancing their testosterone?
Yeah.
I mean, women naturally make estrogen. That's it. Around 14 grams, 30 grams a day. Men are making between 200 and 1100 a day. Now we have a situation where they're saying, let's just throw away biology and science. Forget about it. Because these people want to do whatever they want to do just for the sake of what?
Power.
Can someone answer that? What are power. They doing it for?
Thanks for the call. What are they doing it for? Power. Power, power, power. Deconstruct the foundations of Western civilization. Marriage. Gender. Power, 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 power. This is all the state. Anytime you look at something like what is happening culturally, trade, you know, this follow the money, follow the pursuit of power. It always traces back to the same source. Andrew in Aurora. Hey, Andrew.
Hello?
Yep, you're on.
Yeah, so, yeah, I have a stepdaughter who thought it would be a good idea a few years back in high school to join wrestling, and there is no women's wrestling, so she was on the basically men's wrestling team. And after a couple of weeks in a meet, not to let alone watching what it looked like to have all the boys basically grabbing her, but a bigger guy that she had to compete against smashed her foot. I mean, she just got severely injured from the experience, which put her in a cast and, you know, more or less put her out of the running for a scholarship that she was looking for at sports in one of the military academies. Mm. So there's some serious consequences when you start thinking it's a good idea to just sort of mix the sexes and eliminate these distinctions between male and female competition.
Thanks for the call, Andrew. Those are the stories that don't get told. Everybody wants to celebrate the girl who's kicking field goals on the football team. Those are the stories that don't get that told when you actually try to advance this, you know, culturally across the board without consideration other than for politics.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
It's kind of the month of February, you know, build you up to Valentine's Day. That's when they all have all the trinkets out and candy, shoving it down our throats that you have to be loved by somebody today.
On AM 560.
Okay. The only reason for this day is for me to take and not give. I want chocolate.
Chocolate! The Answer.
Yeah, lovely Valentine's Day sentiment from our listener, one of our listeners, Dennis in Crystal Lake there.
Did you send Dennis chocolate? Because that's all he wants. I want chocolate.
I heard loud and clear. We also heard loud and clear Jesse Smollett break his silence this morning on Good Morning America in one of those softball interviews Robin Roberts has become famous for.
Well, she looked very concerned, you know, because, are you okay, Jesse? Is it going to be okay? But the first question she asked was, what happened that night?
What happened that night, Jesse?
When I landed in Chicago and Frank Gatson, who's like my uncle, and he's also my creative director, and he picked me up.
Creative director.
And then we got back to the apartment. There was no food. And so I went out to Walgreens thinking that they were 24 hours and to have a smoke. Walgreens was closed. So I called him up and I said, hey, I'm going to run to Subway, which was across the street, and I'm going to get a salad. Do you want anything? I went to the Subway and got the order. During that time, I texted my manager thinking that he was still in Australia because he was on an Australian tour with one of his other clients. Mm-hmm. And I said, yo, call me when you can. He called me immediately. And while he was on the phone, I heard, as I was crossing the intersection, I heard Empire. And I don't answer to Empire. My name ain't Empire. And I didn't answer. I kept walking, and then I heard Empire. So I turned around and I said, did you just say to me? And I see the attacker masked. And he said, this MAGA country punches me right in the face. So I punched it back. And then we started tussling. You know, it was very icy. And we ended up tussling by the stairs. Fighting. There was a second person involved who was kicking me in my back. And then it just stopped. And they ran off. And I saw where they ran. And the phone was in my pocket, but it had fallen out. And it was sitting there. And my manager was still on the phone. So I picked up the phone and I said, Brandon. And he's like, what's going on? And I said, I was just jumped. And I looked down and I see that there's a rope around my neck, which I hadn't.
You hadn't noticed it before?
No,
you
didn't because it was so fast. You know what I'm saying? It was so fast.
How long did this all
It felt
take
like for? Minutes, but it probably was like 30 seconds, honestly. I can't tell you, honestly. I noticed the rope around my neck, and I started screaming. And I said, there's a rope around my neck.
So I guess a couple of things just from that statement. One is, I wonder if police have any information about injuries to his hands, scrapes on his hands, because he said, and this I hadn't heard this before,
that he punched back. I never knew that before.
Punched back. So if he was in an altercation with two guys, and then he threw a punch as well and landed it, that's the way he sounded. I wonder if there's anything on his hands.
There almost would have to be.
Well, maybe.
So he first refused Chicago police to come over and help him.
Well, one other thing. The other thing is, they just ran off. You're in a fight. You're fighting back. A second guy's kicking you, and then they just run off. Well, do you have any idea? Follow up would be. Do you have any idea why they would just run off if they're in this scrape with you? Why would they just then stop and run off
and not finish them? I don't know. Maybe they're just trying to send a message. I don't know.
I don't know either. But I would be interested to hear his perspective on that question.
Yeah, he couldn't. You know, it's wintertime in Chicago. People walk around with ski masks. He couldn't say what race they were.
Mm-hmm.
He thought that they were the guys in the surveillance video. We've played that earlier for you. But this is what happened with what was the interaction like with Chicago police?
So during that time before they came, it took them about maybe half hour to come, and during that time, I was looking at myself, just like checking myself out. I saw the bruise on my neck, like the little the rope burn around my neck. And then I smelled bleach. I know the smell of bleach. And I saw on my sweatshirt, it had marks on it, like spots on it when you have a bad bleach job. So then I was like, there's bleach on me too. So when the police came, I kept the clothes on. I kept the rope.
So you had the rope on the entire time?
I mean, it wasn't like wrapped around, but yeah, it was around because I wanted them to see. I wanted them to see what this was. I told them what happened, everything. I also asked them to turn their body cams off because they were trying to stay in the hallway. And I was like, please just come in. Like, I don't want a big scene with my neighbors and with like the second round of police officers. I went down to where it happened and I walked them through exactly what happened. And I looked up and I saw that there was a camera directly on the light post that is in the intersection. So I'm like, there it is. And then the detective told me that the camera inside of the casing was facing north.
So he doesn't remember, didn't realize it at the time, either that rope was being put around his neck or that he was being doused with bleach.
He claimed, did you hear him? He said he had a rope burn on his neck.
Right.
But he doesn't remember. He just looked down and there was a rope. If somebody was pulling you with a rope, I would remember that. It was like all of a sudden, poof, I looked down. Oh, wait, I have a rope around my neck. But it's not tied tight because he said that.
But it was tight enough to create a burn.
And listen to this. This is racial. This whole incident is racial. Listen.
It's 2:00 in the morning. You're going to Subway. Subway
is open 24 hours. Like, people kill me when they say things like that because it's like Subway is open 24 hours for a reason. So that when you're hungry at night and you ain't got no food, you go to Subway. The camera facing north. Okay. How is that my issue? It feels like if I had said it was a Muslim or a Mexican or someone black,
right.
I feel like the doubters would have supported me a lot much more, a lot more. And that says a lot about the place that we are in our country right now.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so, Jesse.
I don't think so either.
I think it's the specifics and your actions since the alleged attack occurred. That's the issue. Somebody is indifferent to somebody being beaten up and that was allegedly racially motivated or motivated because he's gay. I mean, I don't know how anybody would know that. I don't even know how anybody would know who this guy is. A couple of white guys with MAGA hats, big Trump supporters, and big Empire fans. Okay, it's possible.
I don't think there's one that exists.
I'd like to see the Venn diagram. That's all.
Okay.
I'd like to see the Venn diagram of Empire watchers and Trump loyalists or racist Trump supporter Empire watchers. I'd like to see that Venn. But it's cheap. It's cheap for him to bring race into it. The reason he's doing this interview is because there are doubters. If this was marginal, if this was proceeding in a sensible way that wasn't prompting questions, including, by the way, from Chicago police saying, for example, as we reported yesterday, the redacted phone log you gave us can't support a criminal investigation. We need more. So that's being uncooperative. So if there weren't issues like that, then we wouldn't be raising the questions that have been raised, so much so that you felt the need to go on to Good Morning America to have your one-sided say to try to, you know, essentially buttress your claims.
Well, Robin Roberts asked him about his phone, why he didn't initially hand it over, and then these heavily redacted phone records that don't prove at all that he was on the phone with his manager at the time of the attack that he just said happened.
I'm sorry, but I'm not going to do that.
Why?
Because I have private pictures and videos and numbers, my partner's number, my family's number, my castmates' number, my friends' numbers, my private emails, my private songs, my private voice memos. I don't know what that's going to be to hand over my phone for. And honestly, by then, inaccurate false statements had already been put out there.
Well, so what? So inaccurate false statements have been put out there, so correct the record. I mean, the point is not to, I don't know, win the narrative competition in the public arena. It's to help police solve this crime and find the attackers, isn't it?
All he could have done is gone to recent phones and show them that, look, at this time at 2 a.m.-ish, I was on the phone with my manager. Our phone conversation lasted 12 minutes. That's all he had to do. He wouldn't even do that.
Yeah, he could.
He wouldn't hand over his phone, and then the phone records that he handed over does not prove that he was on the phone with his manager at the time of the alleged attack.
He could.
Bottom line.
You could have somebody dupe it or dupe portions of the,
yeah,
the data on the phone. I mean, it's not that onerous. Fine, I get it. Whatever. Let's say, hey, he's skeptical of police. He's a black gay man. He's bought into the Black Lives Matter rhetoric. Let's just say, for example.
He hates President Trump.
So, whatever. So he plausible.
Deniable.
Trying to present something that's plausible from his perspective. Let's say he's takes the perspective that police are antagonists. They're not his friends. And so he's reticent to turn it all over. Okay, fine. But then don't claim this is racially motivated when people are asking questions. He'd be asking they'd be asking questions regardless of who the attackers are. Because, oh, by the way, one of the questions is with respect to the attackers. I mean, there are people. Let's find the alleged attackers. Why isn't there on video? People are asking that question not because of the prospective race of whoever allegedly attacked him, because where are the attackers? Let's get them. Let's get them if they're out there.
Yeah.
And let's help police get them.
Right. But the one surveillance video that they released, they have not received one tip from anyone.
Except that one woman who, you know, provided that sort of eyewitness account
to TMZ
of the guy she saw standing outside when she walked her dog. But that hasn't led anywhere.
Yeah, because it didn't happen. They checked surveillance video and there was no two guys standing out there wearing camel dress shoes.
By the way, there's a lot of residents in Streeterville, as interviewed by the New York Post, my neighborhood, by the way, who don't believe a story. And it's not because they're Trump loyalists or racists.
No,
they just don't buy it.
Muslims, they interviewed African Americans, and none of them believe him.
John and Woodridge, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, this guy's a good actor, man. He's just playing good acting, and I think the manager set all this up for him, so there's good publicity. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, John. Manager or creative director?
I mean, well, he has his creative director, Fred, who's like an uncle to him, and then his manager is the one whose apartment he was in when police arrived.
Phil in Deerfield.
Good morning, guys. Can you give me an example of a case where the police department, any police department, anywhere in America, has taken personal information obtained from a phone and used it to their advantage, where there's been an investigation or there's been a crime committed and it's gone in jail? That's like someone saying, I don't want to give you my personal information to get a mortgage.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, thanks for the call. Yeah, I mean,
it's ridiculous. They're not going to go through his notes and his songs and steal his lyrics.
I have my partner's phone number on there. So
we don't even know you have a partner. We don't care.
Well, so what? What do you think the police are going to do?
They're going to call your...
Detectives are going to start calling everybody in your phone and say, hey, I got your number from Jesse. I just wanted to say hi.
Yeah, Terrence Howard. What's the name? The lead guy from Empire?
Yeah, Terrence Howard.
Yeah.
Who also should be interacting with police more often, or less often, as the case may be. That guy's a bad dude.
Yeah.
Not a good person.
No, not a good person. I agree.
John in Palatine.
Hey, Dan and Amy. I was thinking about it from a practical perspective, and back to my time in grade school when you have to remember it was sub-zero weather, and when that happened, my mom would bundle me up, and I'd wear a Spider-Man mask, and I don't think a baseball cap could fit over a mask. And he's talking about plural, too. So did they actually have outfits, like two masks with two MAGA caps? And during the scuffle, all of this garb is still staying together? So it just sounds really weird. The police should investigate that.
Thanks for the call, John.
Well, they said this is MAGA country, but they weren't wearing MAGA hats.
Right. Yeah. Because they had ski masks on. That's why he couldn't identify the race, right?
Right. And he couldn't tell their eye color either. Whatever.
David and McCook. Hey, David.
Hey, happy Valentine's Day, guys.
Oh, thank you so much.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Would you be my Valentine?
Thank you. Hey, this guy should win an Academy Award, and I'm not talking about his role on Empire. What a liar.
Okay.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy are talking about Jussie Smollett, his Good Morning America interview. Brad in the West Loop, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, yeah. Hi, Dan and Amy. Yeah, I've been an extra on the show. I'm a white Trump supporter. I'm conflicted. I've never had anything but positive interactions with him. I've been directed by him, been around him a lot, and he's just a great guy. And I honestly don't know what to think.
Well, do you think he made up the story to help his career?
I don't know why he would have. That's the thing. I don't know what he was doing. I mean, you know, you're asking for the one guy who watches the show who's white and Trump supporter. That's me.
Okay.
That's a Venn diagram. Yeah. A sliver.
Yeah. I don't know why he would have done it. I don't know what he would have gained from doing it in the first place. He didn't have to go to the police in the first place. What prompted him? That's the question.
Yeah.
If he's faking it, why did he do that in the first place? He didn't need the attention.
Because he had an 8 a.m. Wasn't he supposed to be at work at 8 a.m. the next day and he had a bruise on his face?
Yeah, but they got makeup. They could have delayed the scene. They could have done so many things. They've covered for a lot of other people for, you know, actors and other shows for things.
They got to put makeup on all of Terrence Howard's girlfriends.
Hey-o.
Thanks for the call, Brad. Appreciate the perspective.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, as we reported on this show, Governor Spaulding and his merry band of House and Senate Democrats moving to compete with the Democrats in Virginia, the Democrats in New York, to be the most pro-infanticide party in the country. The four prongs that we reported would be included in legislation to move in Springfield this week are included. Repeal of parental notification, repeal of partial birth abortion ban, insurance mandate. Make if you want to sell insurance plans in Illinois, got to have the abortion coverage, and allow for non-doctors to perform abortions. Bit of a funny moment in Springfield too. So you get a little bit of a sense of the ruling class mentality. Mike Madigan talking to Illinois News Network reporter Greg Bishop about term limits.
Speaker, the Senate caucus has leadership term limits. The Republican caucus has leadership term limits.
Thanks, she have term limits for you.
She have term limits for you, the media. Media term limits, not politician term limits here.
Yeah, it's going to be our overlord for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, it's going very well. So this is a move building off of Benedict Rohner's signing of House Bill 40, taxpayer funding of abortion on demand. This is a move to, as we talked to Cesar LaFleur, yesterday to make Illinois the most, well, to make Illinois the abortion capital of the country by targeting young people, young women, and minorities in particular, young female minorities in particular. Thus, the Planned Parenthood clinics going up in places like the south suburbs along the Indiana border, majority minority populations. We played before our discussion with Cesar LaFleur yesterday, talking about the crisis pregnancy center, Aid for Women Pregnancy Care Center, that's opening up near that Planned Parenthood clinic in Flossmoor. Played an interview Lila Rose from Live Action did with Dr. Anthony Levitino, just trying to introduce some actual science, medicine about obstetrics into the conversation of partial birth and live birth and all of this ghoulish business that we've been discussing and watching play out over the last several weeks around the country. And got a lot of feedback from it because, you know, people just don't know. I didn't know until I watched the interview, all the details that Dr. Levitino provided in terms of how you actually deal with tending to a female who is in a health crisis while pregnant. And it was really illuminating. So we thought, well, why don't we continue the conversation by getting the doctor himself? And so we have him, Dr. Anthony Levitino, OBGYN. Dr. Levitino, please, thank you so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Happy to be here.
So just picking up on the move in states like Illinois, New York, Virginia to provide for late-term, I mean, places like Virginia, according to the governor, full-term, outside of the womb, quote-unquote, abortions. And it's always couched two ways, reproductive rights, number one, and number two, we're talking about cases of health and welfare of the mother. And you tackled the health and welfare of the mother of the patient, one of the two patients, very well. And I just wanted you to address that in that context of these late-term abortions.
Well, you know, if you ask the average person, name one Supreme Court decision, 99.9% of people will say Roe v. Wade, because most people don't know the name of any other Supreme Court decisions. And many people, of course, understand that Roe v. Wade basically established abortion as a, quote, right, but don't understand what the ruling actually says. Roe v. Wade set up, remember, and this was consistent with medicine in 1973 when Roe v. Wade was ruled on. It set up a trimester framework. Obstetricians use a trimester framework when we describe pregnancy. Pregnancy is 40 weeks long. And the first 13 weeks is the first trimester, up to about 27 weeks is the second trimester, and 27 to 40 weeks is the third trimester. And what Roe said about late-term procedures is that a state could prohibit abortions in the third trimester, this is 27 weeks until term, unless the woman's health was being affected. Now, and pro-aborts have used this very effectively over the years. I mean, who could possibly be against a woman's health? But lawyers in the audience understand that in law, every single word means something. And what Roe didn't do was define the term health. Now, there's a companion case the same day called Doe versus Bolton, which most people have never heard of. Doe did define health. It includes the mother's physical health, but it didn't say how severe it needed to be, how severely affected her health would have to be to justify a third trimester abortion. What if she had cancer? What if she was going to die? That's serious. What if her blood pressure was up? Well, that's treatable. What if she had a headache? It doesn't say. It also includes her mental health, but again, doesn't specify how seriously threatened her mental health would be. How about she's going to have a psychotic break? How about she's just stressed out? Doesn't say. It includes her economic health. Whoa, how rich do you have to be to qualify for a third trimester abortion? It doesn't say. And it also includes her social health. What in blazes does that mean? I wrote an op-ed recently that may get published about a case I had when I was doing abortions. A 17-year-old high school senior came in and requested and wanted an abortion, and I did it because her reason was she didn't want to be pregnant for her senior prom. So I assume that means her social health. And under Roe, I could justify a third trimester abortion based on that. So this dodge about health has been used for years. Many politicians have said, I'll support your pro-life legislation as long as it has a health exception. They look good because they're guarding women's health. And most people on the outside don't realize that when someone says that, he's actually saying, I'll be happy to support your legislation as long as there's an exception and it's so big, it effectively negates your law.
Right. And so, so people will come back to that explanation and say, well, this is exactly why, doctor, the decision, regardless of where the mother is in her term, this is why the decision should be between the doctor and the woman. And should be provided for up until, up until the child can work outside the home, according to some people. But this is why. It shouldn't be the government shouldn't be involved because of all these variables you just described. That makes it even more important that it's just the doctor and the woman.
I disagree, and I disagree loudly. Let me tell you another real-world situation, and you hear this. Well, we have to trust the woman and her doctor. Really? When I was doing abortions in New York, my partner and I, we had a hospital that we were working with on a regular basis where we did abortions on a regular basis. I mean, early ones we did in our office, and that's still the standard of care. But, you know, when they got bigger, it got more dangerous, and we wanted them in a hospital setting for safety reasons, for the safety of the patient. Well, the board of the hospital did not want us doing abortions in their hospital and told us so. And so we, quote, negotiated with them because we did understand the law. And we pledged, we got them to agree to allow us to do abortions only if they were medically necessary. And using that very same definition I just told you, we just continued doing abortions just like we did before with no restriction at all. All we did from then on was write in the chart, this I certified that this abortion is medically necessary and signed my name. Doctors are an interested party. They're making money doing these things.
Right.
Yeah.
That's how they make their living. I'm not faulting anybody for making a living. But don't sit there and tell me that, you know, that patient's being driven by God knows what forces. And meanwhile, the doctor is, this is how he makes his living. And we're going to leave the decision up to them. We are killing viable, unborn children. A woman is paying a doctor money to kill her perfectly viable, in many cases, unborn son or daughter. And we're going to leave the decision entirely up to them with no state oversight whatsoever. This is absurd.
Well, when did you change your mind? I mean, you've performed over 1,200 abortions in the first and second trimesters. What happened, or when was your aha moment? Not to sound like Oprah, but what happened?
My aha moment, well, I was, as I tell people, I was very dedicated to the idea of abortion. This is a decision, and I took the same tack you just talked about. This is a woman between, this is a decision between a woman, her doctor, and nobody, including the baby's dad, had anything to say about it. And I was very dedicated to that. I was doing these abortions up to 24 weeks. My aha moment came when my daughter, who's 2 months short of being 6 years old, was killed in an auto accident. You know, you've got parents out there listening to this, and if you have children, you may think you have some idea of what that might be like to lose a child. Unless you've been through this yourself, you have absolutely no idea whatsoever, and I pray to God you never find out. But what do you do after a disaster? I mean, you bury your child and you try to get back into your life. And I don't remember exactly how long it was, maybe 3 or 4 weeks after her death, but I showed up at the hospital to do a late-term second trimester D&E abortion. And when I talk about this in front of a group, I describe the abortion so people understand what we're talking about. You have to literally tear a baby to pieces with your bare hands. I mean, it's, you know, using instruments, of course, but that's what the procedure is. And I began the procedure, just routine, tore out an arm or a leg and stared at it in the clamp and got sick. You know, but when you start an abortion, you can't stop. You have to keep inventory. You have to make sure that you get all the pieces, all the arms, legs, internal organs, the head, all the rest of it. Because if you don't and you leave tissue behind, your patient's going to come back infected, bleeding, or dead. So I soldiered on and I finished that abortion. And I tell people, I know it sounds strange, but I'm telling you it's for real. For the first time in my life, after all the years and all the abortions I had done, I really looked at that pile of body parts on the side of the table that I had just torn to pieces myself. And I didn't see her wonderful right to choose, and I didn't see what a great doctor I was helping her with her problem, and I didn't even see the $800 cash I just made in 15 minutes back then. All I saw was somebody's son or daughter. And after a whole lot of soul searching and difficulty after that, I quit.
Wow. Wow. That's something. I wanted to get you to explain again, because I don't think people can hear this enough so they understand it. The point you made in your discussion with Lila Rose about late term abortions and your point about the number of abortions, late term abortions you've had to do to save a woman in a health crisis late in her term is zero. Explain that.
There are times abortion, if you want to call it that, is necessary. If a woman is 8 weeks from her last menstrual period and she has a tubal pregnancy, pregnancy's in the tube, not in the uterus where it belongs. Yeah. It's called an ectopic pregnancy. And you do an ultrasound and you see a beating heart, it makes no difference. You must treat the condition or she is going to die. Okay? So there are times what people would call a quote abortion are necessary to save her life. And that's probably one of the most common situations that we see. Ectopic pregnancies are actually very common. However, when you're talking about the vast majority of problems, when we talk of late abortions in the third trimester or second or third trimester to save her life, a baby is viable. That baby with proper care can live on the outside starting around 22 weeks. There are variations. Some kids who are earlier have made it. Some kids who are later haven't. But around 22 weeks, little over halfway through her pregnancy, that child can live on the outside on its own with proper care. Okay, it's viable. The vast majority, and I worked in a high-risk center, a high-risk university hospital in New York that took care of patients who were in serious trouble with their pregnancies, cancers, severe heart disease, out-of-control diabetes, preeclampsia or toxemia of pregnancy. Many of your listeners know what this is. Typical situation. This is a real case. Woman comes in 27 weeks pregnant, way over the line of viability. Everyone knows, or many people know, that normal blood pressure is 120 over 80. Her blood pressure was 220 over 100, 160. Okay, she was minutes or hours away from a stroke, right? Her pregnancy is going to kill her, okay? But you know what? It's the pregnancy that's dangerous to her, not the baby. It's the pregnancy. Hmm. And if you want to save her life, you end the pregnancy, which is exactly what we did. We stabilized her. We did a cesarean section within an hour. She and the baby did just fine, okay? It's not the baby that's threatening the mother. It's the pregnancy. So when you have a crisis in pregnancy, and especially when it's past viability, which is when almost all of these situations occur, you do a delivery. And the number, and I did that for 9 years. I saved hundreds of women from serious problems in pregnancy, and I did not have to deliberately kill a single child in the process. However, we are told we need late-term abortion to save women's lives. Really? Let's go back to that patient. 220 over 160 blood pressure. If you wanted to do an abortion to save her life, a late abortion at that stage of pregnancy takes 2 to 3 days just to prepare the cervix so that you can do the abortion procedure. You know what? when somebody has a blood pressure of 220 over 160, you don't have 2 or 3 days to make up your mind and fix the problem. You've got hours. And this rubbish about how late-term abortion is necessary to save women's lives is just that, because it takes too long in the vast majority of cases where a real medical emergency is involved.
He is Dr. Anthony Levitino, OBGYN. Dr. Levitino, thank you so much for joining us and providing all of this illumination. This is really important stuff and well said. Really appreciate your time. Thank you.
Happy to help.
Also, too, just a note, the legislation in Illinois, if you want to maybe contact a legislator and say don't support the bills that we described at the outset of our conversation, House Bill 2495 and House Bill 2467, those are the two bills to make Illinois more pro-abortion, more pro-infanticide than it already is.
And the doctor joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
This is my gift to humankind. People will pay good money for my knowledge.
On AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, we've talked a bit about this, but not recently. Amid some concerns about a housing bubble being reblown up, Fannie and Freddie bigger and badder than they were before the bubble burst in 08, the Great Recession ensued.
Familiar with what happened.
Of course, Michael Lewis made a bunch of money The Big Short. But is everybody missing an important piece of the story with respect to housing policy predated and precipitated the Great Recession? There's a new book by Kevin Erdman called Shutout, How Housing Shortage Caused the Great Recession and Crippled Our Economy. Not Fannie and Freddie, lending to, signature loans, lending to people who couldn't pay back, the HELOCs to buy the second home that you couldn't afford. So not loose lending that gave rise to more government bureaucracy like CFPB. And not Fannie and Freddie, but a housing shortage, policies that created a housing shortage, particularly in two trouble spots. For more on his book and his research and his perspective, we're pleased to be joined by Kevin Erdman. Kevin, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, as I mentioned, you got Michael Lewis weighing in. We've talked to Bethany McLean, who wrote the book On Shaky Ground about where Fannie and Freddie is a decade after the crash. But your perspective is different. Not too much building or too much lending to low-income people, or even much to say about Fannie and Freddie. Restrictive housing development laws was the main culprit. Explain.
Yeah. So, during the boom, there were loose lending terms. There was there were some deregulatory things that happened that allowed credit to be loose. But to the effect that had anything to do with what became the bubble, it was mostly allowing people in places like San Francisco and L.A. and New York City and Boston that actually have really high incomes, that can afford to live in those cities, to bid up the housing in those cities, and that created the core of the bubble. Now, that created a secondary bubble, which was actually a whole bunch of people moving out of those cities because they couldn't afford to live there anymore, and that ends up overwhelming places like Florida and Arizona and Nevada. Now, Chicago sort of didn't have such a big problem as those cities. Chicago does a bit of a better job allowing new building. But the core of it is actually a lack of building. And I think if you think about, today, this housing affordability issue is, it's getting to be a big conversation again. And you think about cities like San Francisco today, people there aren't mad because poor people are moving in that can't afford houses that are being tricked into mortgages they can't afford, right? They're mad because people with high incomes are moving in and bidding up the rents and the prices and forcing people out. So I think we all see that happening today. And really what I found is actually that was happening in 2005 also. And that was really the core of what triggered the whole event.
And so, how does just going back to Fannie and Freddie and some other policies that perhaps from your perspective at least had a multiplier effect or an amplification effect, Fannie and Freddie, the moral hazard for loose credit and for risky lending that Fannie and Freddie create, how does that factor in your analysis?
You know, really, I didn't have a strong opinion about Fannie and Freddie going into this project, and really this project for me was sort of an accident of just finding some of this data that seemed to turn a lot of these conclusions upside down, and so I just kept following my nose down the path of sort of finding this new story. But really, Fannie and Freddie were very countercyclical. I've actually come out of this whole process with a much higher opinion of them as a public institution. During the height of the boom, they actually were losing market share at a pretty incredible rate to these new, you know, those new private markets with subprime and Alt-A loans that were happening. So really, Fannie and Freddie, in just about every way, come out looking pretty good. Their default rates were low compared to all the other conduits. And really, at the end, what I think happened was they were trying to come in and fill in the gaps in 2007 and 2008 when all the other forms of lending had collapsed. And the biggest mistake we made through the entire bubble was not allowing them to come back in and sort of let mortgage lending, continue to be somewhat healthy. And most of the foreclosures that happened, most of the loss of home equity in working class households, working class homes, happened in that like 2009 to 2012 period. And that was actually a late effect that basically happened because we cut back on lending to the low end. And in fact, extra lending to entry level borrowers was never the cause of the bubble in the first place.
Well, everyone keeps saying that within the next year or 2 years, the housing market's going to collapse again. Because if you look at the charts, we go up, go down, go up, go down. Do you think that that's going to happen?
No, I think it's a very different landscape today. And I think one of the things that's really important to think about carefully in terms of housing affordability is the difference between rental value and price. And really, when we think about supply and demand, it's rent. It's the cost over a period of time of what it takes to put a roof over your head. And the home is the service that or is the capital that provides that service. But a lot of times price and rent sort of move in the opposite direction. And in fact, that was happening in 2004 and 2005 during the bubble time. Really what the bubble was doing, even though prices were really high in some cities, and so it seemed excessive, it was actually helping to fund new houses. Since we can't build enough houses in LA and San Francisco and New York City and Boston, it was actually helping to fund households moving out of those cities and building in the other cities we can build. And those households that were moving out of those cities were actually moving away to lower their housing costs. So in most of the country, rents were actually moderating during that time, even though in these pockets, prices were going really high. So it's different today because we cut off lending for a decade to such an extent that we're not building enough houses anywhere anymore. Rents in every city now are going up faster than the regular rate of inflation. So today the affordability problem is due to the actual cost of the houses, due to the actual value of the cash flows that house can create. And so it's the opposite situation. We actually need more houses today, much more than we did then. So we're really not anywhere close to overheating. In fact, if we let the housing market overheat today, it would actually be good, and it would actually eventually lower home prices because eventually we would let those rents start to moderate.
Well, so in this environment then, where you've got people moving south and west in greater numbers, you see explosions in places like Nashville and Dallas and Austin and Charleston and throughout Florida, Scottsdale, Phoenix area. Are the states that are losers in the migration, like Illinois and California and New York, could they be the repositories of the quote-unquote contagion cities that you described in 2008 were in Arizona, Nevada, and Florida? Could it be reversed geographically as well in terms of leading indicators?
I don't see, you know, the thing that I think a lot of people missed in during the housing bubble was there was a real migration event. And I haven't seen that level of migration yet today. Now, the part of the problem is those numbers tend to be a little bit delayed. So it's a year or two later before we see what's really happening. But the key part of that the migration back then was, you know, it's really a perverse sort of position that we put ourselves in as a country. And it's actually really a key factor in like income inequality and all these things that, you know, that have become problems in the economy, is that because those cities have such a hold on housing growth and they sort of cap their populations, but they're also really, you know, the key economic centers, you know, along with Chicago, to sort of tap into the new post-industrial global economy. People would like to move there for work, and incomes there are growing faster than they are anywhere else, and they're higher than they are than in most other places. And so we had this perverse migration that was very highly correlated against income. Like, people were moving to places with lower incomes, which is really, you know, weird. It's a reversal of any past experience we have.
Lower incomes, but significantly lower cost of living.
Exactly. So instead of moving to places with opportunity and, you know, places aspirationally, we're actually moving for compromise to lower costs, but also lower our ability to be productive and to earn a higher income. So I don't see that sort of correlation happening yet today. I mean, we sort of solved the wrong problem, though. Before we were actually partly solving that problem by building houses in other places and allowing people to make that move and lower their costs. Today, they're not making that move because it's so hard for so many people to get mortgages that we can't fund that move anymore. And so they're sort of stuck in the places with high costs. So it actually would, to a certain extent, would be good news to see a little bit of that flow happen again. But the best news would be if we could somehow induce New York and Boston and LA and San Francisco to build houses at a higher rate so people could just live there and earn the high incomes that are available. And as I said, Chicago, at the metro area level, they seem to be doing a decent job. They didn't have quite that signature of extremely high costs, extremely high out migration, and, you know, they build houses at a higher rate than those other cities.
Well, in the last decade, that out-migration has changed significantly in Chicago, Illinois leading the nation in out-migration, and Chicago a big part of that. But, yes, I take your point. Really interesting. I'm looking forward to getting into your book a little bit more. I became aware of it through Tyler Cohn's Marshall Revolution blog, and if Tyler Cohn is intrigued by it, then it's intriguing. He's Kevin Erdman. The book is Shutout, How a Housing Shortage Caused the Great Recession and Crippled Our Economy. Kevin, thanks for joining us. Good luck with the book.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer.
All right. Get mushy-gushy on us.
Listen up. Valentine's Day message. St. Valentinus was martyred in 269 AD by Emperor Claudius Gothicus for defying him and marrying soldiers. So, hey, fellas out there, the least you could do for St. Valentinus from Rome,
hey, I got a guy,
is express your love for your wife or girlfriend today.
Busting my onions.
How about
over
that?
Here.
All right. Here's my Valentine's Day message. Won't you be mine?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.